Part 4. An Egg Before It Cracks. Email from Agnes Petrella. Date, July 28, 2000. Time, 10:01 p.m. From Agnes Petrella. agnesinwonderland76@omitted.com. To Zoe Cross. Crushed marigolds at omitted.com. Subject. An apology I owe you. Hey, I understand if you'd rather not talk to me after the way I left things over a month ago, but I've been thinking so much about you lately. It probably doesn't help that I have the apple peeler pinned to my kitchen wall. There were so many times I had contemplated whether or not I should just send it to you with a note telling you how sorry I am. But I worried you might toss out the box before you even opened it. Not that you don't have a right to be mad. You are well within reason to not want to talk to me, or to simply tell me to fuck off. Of course, I hope you don't do those things. But what I'm trying to say is that I understand if that's how you feel. I did something to you I'll never forgive myself for as long as I live. After all your consideration, your kindness, to have it thrown back in your face with the same disregard that people might consider when contemplating weekly trash disposal. There's no worse insult I can think of. It was never my intention to hurt you. I don't really think I'm better off without you. I should have never said that. Sometimes we say or do things to people we love because we know it will hurt them. Besides, what I had done nearly isn't as horrible as what some other people have done. For God's sake, there are people who impale baby birds with toothpicks, or people who pour bleach inside cats' ears. I don't know about you, but hearing about the terrible things other people have done have always made me feel better about the things I've done. I remember watching a TV interview with a teenager who had crucified his little brother. You probably heard about it. He called his brother the little Christ because his parents endlessly doted on the child. Anyway, they had him in handcuffs on TV, dressed in an orange jumpsuit, chatting with a reporter, and he starts talking about how he did it. He waits until his parents go to sleep one night, and he creeps into the nursery, spooning his baby brother from his cradle into his arms. The child makes little mewling noises like a kitten, but he keeps a blanket over his mouth to muffle the sounds. After he's finished loading up the car with the supplies he needs, he ferries the little Christ from the house to the back seat of his station wagon. He shifts the car into gear, and before long he's on the road, hurtling down the highway as if he were bound for the promised land, Shangri-La, anywhere but here. He thinks about how he should do it first. Should he just kill him and get it over with? Or should he take his time and make it as perfect as possible? So, after driving for about half an hour, they arrive at the rock quarry on the outskirts of town. He drives to the small ledge overlooking the nearby park where those evangelists built a giant crucifix out of unused pine. So he pulls the little Christ out of the car seat and hauls him up toward the cross. The crucifix isn't very large, maybe 6 feet tall at the most. So, he positions the little Christ against it, splaying his limbs out against the wood. The child struggles a little. He looks around confused, bands of drool collecting in the corners of his little mouth. It's now or never, he thinks to himself. So, he reaches inside the rucksack he's brought with him, and he pulls out a hammer and a small nail. He presses the little Christ's hand against the arm of the cross, and that's when he starts to cry, as if the child somehow realizes what he's about to do. Whether he knows his fate before it happens or not, it soon becomes clear to him when he swings the hammer down and smashes the nail through the palm of his little hand. He shrieks as if he were a wounded animal. It sounds almost inhuman, pitiful, like the final pathetic cry of a dying species. A breed on the verge of being swallowed by oblivion. He can't stop now. He's already gone too far. Blood's leaking from the hole he's opened in the little Christ's hand. So he holds him up to keep him from falling, and he rummages through his rucksack again, until he finds another nail. He stretches his other hand along the other arm of the cross, and smashes the hammer down, until the nail disappears in a bubble of blood. He removes his hands from him, and he lets the child dangle there, his palms tearing gently under the weight of being held up by the small nails. The little Christ hangs there, screaming until hoarse, like some sacred offering for an ancient deity. The noise is almost unbearable, but he's not finished yet. So he pulls out a small hunter's knife his father had given him for his 12th birthday. He slices the baby's belly open until a thin line of blood creeps from the tiny hole he had opened there. It's finished. He doesn't have a crown of thorns to complete the likeness, but he thinks the little Christ doesn't deserve one. Once he's finished arranging the child on the cross, braiding ropes around his arms to keep him from falling, he returns to the car to retrieve his paint supplies. He sets his easel up in a small area not far from the cross, and as the dawn breaks, he begins to work on his painting. It's not long before the little Christ's screams dim until they're soundless, his head lowering as if in prayer. He doesn't bother to check, but he knows he's dead. He doesn't remember what happens next until he sees flashing lights, red and blue, idling toward his car on the quarry's ledge. The interviewer asks the teenager, "If you could see your baby brother again, what would you say to him?" The teenager inhales, as if thinking deeply. Then, quite matter-of-factly, he stares straight ahead at the interview with a blank expression and says one word. "Nothing." "I could never dream of being a monster like that. Neither of us are monsters. Don't we deserve a second chance? I hope you'll accept this email as my apology, and if you're willing, of course, I hope you'll accept me as your drudge once more to be faithful to you and to give myself entirely to you. I'll be waiting for your email. Love, Agnes." Email from Agnes Petrella. Date, July 30th, 2000. Time, 11:37 p.m. From Agnes Petrella. Agnes in Wonderland 76 at omitted.com. To Zoe Cross. Crushed Marigolds at omitted.com. Subject, Ray, an apology I owe you. Please write back. I promise to dedicate myself entirely to you. I'm not better off without you. I wrote you that story about the little Christ because I wanted to show you there are worse people in the world. We don't belong in their company. We belong together. I know we do. Agnes. Email from Zoe Cross. Date, July 31st, 2000. Time, 8:32 p.m. From Zoe Cross. Crushed Marigolds at omitted.com. To Agnes Petrella. Agnes in Wonderland 76 at omitted.com. Subject, Ray, an apology I owe you. Agnes. I'm sorry if I've been keeping you on edge the past few days since you sent your first email. I've been unexpectedly busy at work, and I've been trying my best to stay afloat while juggling so many different projects. I, of course, accept your apology. I was hoping you would eventually reach out, as I've been thinking of you a lot lately as well. I agree to resuming our contract and moving forward with your proposal. I don't necessarily think we need to agree to the contract again, as we both understand the consequences of going against what the document stipulates. However, I do want it known that I require full obedience and honesty if this relationship is to thrive. Any disloyalty, deceit, or non-compliance will be met with the termination of the contract, and we will once again go our separate ways. I'll be on Instant Messenger tomorrow night at 11. We can discuss more then. Yours, Zoe. Instant messaging conversation between Agnes and Zoe. July 31st, 2000. Crushed Marigold has entered the chat. Agnes in Wonderland 76 has entered the chat. 11 o'clock. Crushed Marigolds. Hey, right on time. Agnes in Wonderland 76. I told you things would be different now. Yes, I'm glad. Glad you're here. Glad you came back. I could never stay away from you. You're the only person in my life who hasn't asked me to leave. Why would I do that? When I was little, I thought if people hurt you, it meant that they loved you.
What made you think that?
My parents worked a lot when I was younger, and they asked my aunt to look after me while they were out. My aunt used to play a game with me to keep me quiet, keep me out of the way. She would make me hold an egg and send me into a locked broom closet. She used to make me stand in there, holding the egg for hours on end. When it was time to come out, she used to inspect the egg and make sure it hadn't cracked. If it had cracked, she used to make me eat it. Every last drop, even the shell. I'd stand there crying, eggs smeared all over my face, and she'd say, "I only do this because there are people out there who will do far worse to you." I guess that's what makes people do horrible things. They think whatever they're doing isn't nearly as bad as what somebody else will do.
I would never do anything horrible to you.
I know you wouldn't.
Everything I've asked of you, I've made you do. It's been from a place of love.
I know it has. That's why I came back. Someone else would do far worse things to me.
I would never let that happen. We made an arrangement, remember?
Yes. Do you ever worry you'll hurt me?
Sometimes. I once dreamt about killing you. It wasn't one of those dreams you wake up from in a cold sweat, heart pumping like an engine, feeling like you've just run headfirst into a concrete wall, skull cracked open and juices leaking everywhere. And it definitely wasn't one of those dreams where you wake up and find the place between your legs wetting, thighs clenching at the mere reminder of the memory. Wasn't even a dream you remember when you first wake up. It was something that came to me over time, slowly crawling around inside my head like a beetle, circling some invisible drain fixed inside there, and making its way down into the sludge where memories collect. In the dream, you didn't speak. You couldn't. In the way that all dreams give you supernatural powers, abilities beyond comprehension or even logic, I was able to make you mute. Mouth could open, but no sound could come out. When I asked you why you couldn't speak, you gestured to my hand. It was then that I realized I had ripped out your tongue, and it wiggled between my fingers like a rubbery slice of uncooked meat. You had showed up on my front porch, suitcase in hand. I asked you what you're doing here. You tell me you have nowhere else to go. Before I can challenge you again, there's a horrible explosion outside. I go to the window to look, and I'm greeted by a desolate wasteland. The front lawn, once a beautiful emerald carpet, now merely rusted brown and the edges burning. In the distance, a giant mushroom cloud rises into sight. The light around us dims as if the hand of God had drawn a dark curtain over the world. The windows to the house explode. A glittering hailstorm of glass flutters around us like a snow squall. I suddenly realize you're gone, and it's then I'm approached by a nurse, and she tells me that you're upstairs waiting for me.
"Upstairs," I say. So I walk up the stairs to the master bedroom. And somehow I already have the key to unlock the door. I open it, and it's not the master bedroom, but a giant hospital room instead. It looks like a place where they do experiments, crimes against nature, like arranging the head of a hamster on the body of a Burmese python, something atrocious like that. So, I inch further into the room, and I see you in the hospital bed. Only difference is all your skin has been burned off. Your arms and legs, they look like thin tubes of blood sausage with the transparent casing still on them. Your face, half melted and dripping like the wax from a candle. Your skin, shining from the radiation, and so transparent that I can practically see myself in the reflection. You look so strange and yet so mesmerizing. Tubes and wires are connected to your fingers, snaking in and out of your mouth and nostrils, a desperate effort to keep you alive any way possible, keep you permanently living in your agony. I inch closer toward the bed to look at you, and for some reason I savor the moment. I savor the sight of you in pain, your eyes pleading with me to end your suffering. I think to myself, if I were an ice pick, I'd scramble your brain like a plate of eggs. I think to myself, if I were a black hole, I'd swallow you and shit you out in tiny pieces. I think to myself, if I were a tomahawk,
I'd split you right down the middle like a rotten piece of fruit. I'd do anything I could to erase you, smear you against the world the way a boot wipes off a squished worm on a scraper. You motion for me to lean closer, so I do. You can't speak, but I see your lips moving with muted words. And you mouth the words to me. Kill me, you say, over and over again. Kill me. Kill me. With what? I ask. Your eyes merely wander to the machine keeping you alive beside your bed. I follow your eyes, and it's then I see the plug in the wall. I don't hesitate at all. One yank and it's decided. The line flattens on the screen. Doctors and nurses, their faces hidden behind surgical masks, rush into the room and examine you. They don't do much. Merely shut your eyelids before passing a white sheet over your face. Then they turn to me. You have to take her place now, they say to me. But I'm not sick, I say. Look at me, I'm fine. Then I look down and I realize my skin has been burned off too. Shining tissue, blistered red, staring back at me in my skin's reflection. It's not long before I take your place, reclining in the bed, machines keeping me alive. Only this time, there's nobody around to pull the plug for me. Are you still there? Yeah, I'm here. Dreams can tell us things. What did that dream tell you? How I would never want to hurt you. Yes. Also, how much I love you. Love? Does that word scare you? No, I like it. It sounds nice. I can't stay on. Early work day tomorrow. You'll email me? Why wouldn't I? Good. I love you. Love you. Crushed Marigolds has left the chat. Agnes in Wonderland 76 has left the chat. Email from Agnes Petrella. Date, August 1st, 2000. Time, 10:09 a.m. From Agnes Petrella. Agnes in Wonderland 76 at omitted.com. 2. Zoe Cross. Crushed Marigolds at omitted.com. Subject. I've been thinking a lot about our conversation the other night, and I don't want to leave any opportunity for vagueness. I promised myself I would live unapologetically and damn anybody who finds it offensive. I need to be as candid with you as I can possibly be. I, at the very least, owe you my honesty. I want us to have a baby. I know what you're thinking. I know you probably think I'm crazy, but I've been thinking about this for quite some time. And I think it's only natural for the two of us to create life together. We love one another, don't we? We belong together. I want to carry your life inside me. I, of course, haven't considered the details, but all I know is I want to make this happen between us. I need to make this happen. What do you think? Email from Zoe Cross. Date, August 1st, 2000. Time, 5:12 p.m. From Zoe Cross, Crushed Marigolds at omitted.com. To Agnes Petrella, Agnes in Wonderland 76 at omitted.com. Subject, Ray, I've been thinking. Agnes, I've been thinking about your email all day. I don't quite know how to respond, and I certainly hope I don't come across as uncaring given the brevity of this email I'm writing. Of course I love you. Of course I would want to have a child with you. But it's just not possible right now. I don't know if it ever will be, but I know for certain that it's something I can't accept ownership of at the moment. I so desperately wish I could give you exactly what you desire. I've been thinking, too. Thinking of ways we both can get what we want. I think I've come up with a solution, but I'm apprehensive to share my idea over email. I was hoping we could chat on Instant Messenger again tonight so I can share with you my idea. Don't worry, my love. The agony of uncertainty won't last for long. Zoe. Instant messaging conversation between Agnes and Zoe. August 1st, 2000. Crushed Marigolds has entered the chat. Agnes in Wonderland 76 has entered the chat. 10:32.
crushed marigolds. Hey. Agnes in Wonderland 76. Hey.
You're not upset, are you?
I'm bracing myself for the worst.
And why's that?
You don't want to have a baby with me.
That's not true.
You know that's not true. I'd give anything to be able to give you exactly what you want. It's just not possible right now.
I know.
But there's something you can do, if you're serious about wanting to carry life inside you.
Yes.
You're certain you're serious?
I want it more than anything.
Then you have to get sick.
Get sick?
Yes.
Sick with what?
What exactly is a baby before it's born?
What do you mean?
It lives off a host body like a parasite.
I suppose.
A child is an infection, like a parasite.
You're saying...
You have to become infected. Become infected with a parasite and carry the creature as if it were your child.
Will it hurt?
Change always hurts, but it will give you the life you've always wanted to carry inside you.
You're certain it's the only way?
It would give you exactly what you wanted.
How do you know?
I contracted a tapeworm in college during a trip to Cambodia. I know what it feels like.
What did it feel like?
Feels like you're living for something else. Makes you feel like a god, carrying something alive inside you.
Yes, that's what I wanted it to feel like.
You'll think about it?
Yes, I'll think about it.
I'll love you no matter what.
I love you too, no matter what.
Crushed Marigolds has left the chat. Agnes in Wonderland 76 has left the chat. Email from Agnes Petrella. Date, August 2nd, 2000. Time, 7:41 a.m. From Agnes Petrella, Agnes in Wonderland 76 at omitted.com. To Zoe Cross, Crushed Marigolds at omitted.com. Subject: Ray, our conversation last night.
Zoe, I'll do it. Love, Agnes.
Email from Zoe Cross. Date, August 2nd, 2000. Time, 10:08 a.m. From Zoe Cross, Crushed Marigolds at omitted.com. To Agnes Petrella, Agnes in Wonderland 76 at omitted.com. Subject: Ray, our conversation last night.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
Now, we have to be as precise as possible when executing this plan. It's not as simple as going to your local butcher and asking for his leanest cut of beef tenderloin. There's, of course, the possibility this won't work and will negatively impact your health. If you're serious about going forward with this, then you're going to have to neglect any semblance of hygiene or formality when preparing to eat. Of course, there are methods by which doctors can remove parasites from their human host. However, there's no conclusive way to actually contract the organism. So, much of what I'm about to tell you is in no way a conclusive way to contract a parasite, but rather ways by which a host may become infected with a parasite. You'll need to go to your local town market and ask for a pound of uncooked beef. After you've acquired the meat, you need to return home and leave the beef in a place where it won't be disturbed. Leave it outside. It won't be long before all kinds of insects will arrive, a glittering haze swallowing the portion of meat until they've finally nourished themselves and laid their eggs deep in its brawn. After 2 days of waiting, you're to go outside and locate the sun-cooked meat. Though it may disgust you, you're to take a knife and fork and hack through the uncooked beef, slice off a small piece, and consume it. You're to do this until the meat is completely gone and you're fully fed. You may want to throw up after you've eaten. You may feel as though you need to. I urge you to keep as much of it down as possible. That's the only way this will work. And of course, you want this to work, don't you? Email from Agnes Petrella. Date, August 5th, 2000. Time, 9:07 p.m. From Agnes Petrella. Agnes in Wonderland 76 at omitted.com. 2. Zoe Cross. Crushed Marigolds at omitted.com. Subject. It's finished. It's over now. The worst part is behind me. Chewing on that, the way the little eggs burst between my teeth like sunflower seeds. I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll bet you want to know how it happened. I did exactly what you said. I went into town and visited the local market, a horrible place I worked over the summer when I was a teenager. Haven't been there in several years, but I remember the butcher there. This giant man with a pockmarked face dressed in a blood-stained apron. He greeted me at the counter.
"How's your mother?"
he asked, leaning over and exposing the dark stains beneath both of his arms. I made some bland comment about how well she's been. After all, how am I supposed to know? And I asked him how his daughters are. I remember they were in preschool when I worked there. When we were finally past the painful pleasantries, I asked him for a cut of sirloin steak.
"Just the one?"
he asked me. I nodded. When he was done packaging it, it was as neatly packaged as a Christmas present. I recall marveling at the wrapping paper. I remember how, when I was little, I thought exquisitely wrapped slices of meat resembled something too graceful to eat, as if it were the organ of an angel, the innards of some divine being far too consecrated to consume. I returned home and I unwrapped the meat from its packaging. It was as dark red as some rare tropical plant. I lifted the piece of meat from the counter, inhaling its scent. I imagined myself biting into it, my teeth chewing through the toughness as matter separated as if it were damp cotton. I threw the sirloin on a dinner plate and crept outside into the backyard, where I set it down behind a small tree near the fence. Then, I waited. Every morning I would go to the kitchen window and watch as little bugs swarmed over the fresh plate of meat, a dim cloud of insects collecting, as if it were carrion's shadow, tiny winged mourners to prepare and embalm the recently deceased. Finally, at the end of the second day, I made my way out to the tree and half expected the plate to be gone completely thanks to one of nature's little trespassers. But miraculously, it was still there. After swatting away some of the flies glued to the meat, I ferried it back into the kitchen and started to inspect my meal. The sun had drained it of most of its color, little thatches of blight creeping along the edges of the uncooked steak. Ribbons of exposed tissue sprouted along the meat surface, like slashes from a knife on human skin, and burrowing deep inside the yawning crevices were white maggots. I nearly retched at the sight. But I thought of you and knew you would want me to go through with it. So I took a knife and fork from the cupboard and sawed through the uncooked beef. When I was finished, I speared the piece with my fork. It was then that I noticed a tiny maggot, no bigger than the tip of a dressmaker's thimble, squirming across the piece of meat. Even a carcass can carry life, so why not me? Before I allowed my mind to wander too freely, I took a bite. It was like chewing on cooked rubber, little maggots squishing like jelly between my teeth as I gnawed. I took another bite, and then another. I vomited once, but I kept eating, just like you told me to. Finally, the plate was clear. I swallowed, my whole body shuddering at the acrid taste. Now I suppose we wait. That's all we can do. Just think, everything could be different for me tomorrow. My whole life could change. I hope it does. Email from Zoe Cross. Date, August 7th, 2000. Time, 8:33 a.m. From Zoe Cross. Crushed Marigolds at omitted.com. To Agnes Petrella. Agnes in Wonderland 76 at omitted.com. Subject, Ray. It's finished. Hey, you weren't on Instant Messenger last night. I waited for you. Is everything okay? I've been thinking of you. I still can't quite believe you went through with it. I never thought you would. I thought you'd ask to not see me again or tell me off when I first suggested it. But you want this bad enough, I can tell. Write me back so I know you're okay. Love, Zoe. Email from Agnes Petrella. Date, August 8th, 2000. Time, 6:41 p.m. From Agnes Petrella. Agnes in Wonderland 76 at omitted.com. To Zoe Cross. Crushed Marigolds at omitted.com. Subject: Ray, it's finished. It didn't work. After everything I've done, and it didn't work. My roommate took me to the hospital the other night because I couldn't stop vomiting. They ran a bunch of tests and kept me there for observation. But I don't think it's happened. They would have told me, right? They would have seen some sign, something in the tests. I don't know how quickly it works or what it might show up as, but they would have told me they found something inside me after so many tests. There's no point to anything. It doesn't matter. It's always never mattered. Did I ever tell you the one about the cat and the priest? You know, it's been so cold lately. I read somewhere online that you should always check underneath your car before you start it, because sometimes little animals like to nest under there to get warm. Well, my roommate was working late one night, and we needed bread and eggs. So I got in the car and drove down the street to the market on the corner of Ashworth and Beaumont. Picked up the bread and eggs, and a few other things I needed. As I'm walking through the store, I notice there's a priest, dressed in his robes, also shopping. He's dressed in expensive-looking black and has the white collar around his neck. He looks so out of place in this labyrinth of linoleum and fluorescent lighting, like a lost member of some celestial court. So I start to follow him through the store. I don't know why, I just do. I'm about to go up to him and say something. I have no idea what I'm going to say. But he dashes to the express checkout line before I can get his attention. So, after I'm done buying my groceries, I try to catch him out at his car in the parking lot. But once again, he's too quick for me, and he's already ducking into the driver's seat. I happen to glance beneath his car because I see something moving there in the light. Something curled beneath one of the tires. It's a stray cat with a bright orange tail. I wave at him to stop, but he doesn't see me, and the car's tires slide right over the cat. The cat lays there, dead, ropes of its intestines pushed out through its open mouth, its rib cage flattened like a sheet of paper. I wave at the priest, "Stop, please!" He does, rolls down the window. I say, "You just ran over this poor cat." He doesn't even bother to look at it. He merely looks at me and asks, "Does it matter?" And with that, he cranks up his window and speeds off down the lane. And as I'm left standing there with the squeezed out remains of that dead cat, I wonder to myself, does it matter? Does any of this really matter? The answer's no. The answer's always been no.